encouraging sign. Up to Requin's office, where the master of the spire was standing before a mirror, pulling on a long-tailed black evening coat trimmed in cloth of silver. He bared his teeth at the sight of Locke and Jean, the malice in his eyes easily a match for the fiery alchemical glare of his optics.
"Eyes of the Archon," said Selendry, "on their way to arrest Costa and the Ferrer."
Requin growled, lunged forward like a fencer, and backhanded Locke with astonishing force. Locke slid across the floor on his ass and slammed into Requin's desk. Knick-knacks rattled alarmingly above him, and a metal plate clattered to the tiles. Jean moved forward, but the two burly Sinspire attendants grabbed him by the arms, and with a well-oiled click, Selendry had her concealed blades out to dissuade him.
"What did you do, Custer?"
roared Requin. He kicked Locke in the stomach, knocking him back against the desk once again. A wine glass fell from the desktop and shattered against the floor.
"Nothing!" gasped Locke. "Nothing! He just knew, Requin. He knew we were conspiring against him. We had to run. Eyes on our heels."
"Eyes coming to my spire," Requin growled. "Eyes that may be about to violate a rather important tradition of the Golden Steps. You've put me in a very tenuous situation, Costa. You've fucked everything up, haven't you?"
"I'm sorry," said Locke, crawling to his hands and knees. "I'm sorry. There was nowhere else to run. If he got his hands on us..."
"Quite," said Requin. "I'm going down to deal with your pursuers. You two will remain here. We'll discuss this the moment I get back."
"When you come back," thought Locke, "you'll have more of your attendants with you, and Jean and I will slip out the window." It was time to do it. Requin's boot heels echoed first against tile, then against the iron of his little staircase as he descended to the level below. The two attendants holding Jean released him, but kept their eyes on him, while Selendry leaned back atop Requin's desk with her blades out. She stared coldly at Locke as he got back to his feet, wincing.
"No more sweet nothings to mutter in my ear, Costa."
"Selendry, I..."
"Did you know he was planning to kill you, Master the Ferrer? That his dealings with us these past few months hinged on our allowing that to happen?"
"Selendry, listen, please."
"I knew you were a poor investment," she said. "I just never realized the situation would turn so quickly."
"Yes, you were right. I was a bad investment, and I don't doubt that Requin will listen more closely to you in the future, because I never wanted to kill Jerome de Ferrer. Jerome de Ferrer isn't a real person. Neither is Carlo Callas." "In fact," he said, grinning broadly, "you have just delivered us to exactly where we need to be, for the payoff to 2 long years of hard work, so we can rob the fucking hell out of you and your boss." The next sound in the room was that of a Sinspire attendant hitting the wall, with the impression of one of Jean's fists reddening an entire side of his face. Selendry acted with remarkable speed, but Locke was ready for her, not to fight, but simply to duck and weave, and to stay away from that bladed hand of hers. He vaulted over the desk, scattering papers, and laughed as the two of them fainted from side to side, dancing to see who would stumble past its protective bulk first.
"You die then, Costa," she said.
"Oh, and you were planning to spare us? Please. By the way, Leocanto Costa's not real either. So many little things you just do not know, eh?" Behind them, Jean grappled with the second attendant. Jean slammed his forehead into the man's face, breaking his nose, and the man fell to his knees, burbling. Jean stepped behind him and drove his elbow down on the back of the man's neck with all of his upper body behind it. Involved as he was in avoiding Selendry, Locke winced at the noise the attendant's skull made as it struck the floor.
A moment later, Jean loomed behind Selendri, blood from the attendant's broken nose streaming down his face. She slashed with her blades, but Jean's anger had him in a rare, vicious form. He caught her brass forearm, folded her in half with a punch to the stomach, whirled her around, and held her by the arms. She writhed and fought for breath. "This is a nice office," said Jean quietly, as though he'd just shaken hands with Selendri and her attendants rather than beaten the hell out of them. Locke frowned, but went on with the scheme. Time was of the essence. "Watch closely, Selendri, because I can only do this trick once," he said, producing his deck of fraudulent playing cards and shuffling them theatrically. "Is there a liquor in the house? A very strong liquor, the sort that brings tears to a man's eyes and fire to his throat?" He feigned surprise at the presence of a brandy bottle on the shelf behind Requin's desk, next to a silver bowl filled with flowers. Locke seized the bowl, tossed the flowers on the floor, and set the empty container atop the desk. He then opened the brandy bottle and poured the brown liquor into the bowl to a depth of about 3 fingers. "Now, as you can see, I hold nothing in my hands save this perfectly normal, perfectly ordinary deck of perfectly unremarkable playing cards. Or do I?" He gave the deck one last shuffle and then dropped it into the bowl. The alchemical cards softened, distended, and began to bubble and foam. Their pictures and symbols dissolved, first into a color-streaked white mess, then into an oily gray goo. Locke found a rounded buttering knife on a small plate at a corner of the desk, and he used it to vigorously stir the grey goo until all traces of the playing cards had vanished.
"What the hell are you doing?" Selendri asked.
"Making alchemical cement," said Locke. "Little wafers of resin painted to look like cards, formulated to react with strong liquor. Sweet gods above, you do not want to know what this cost me. Hell, I had no choice but to come rob you after I had it made."
"What do you intend?"
"As I know from vivid personal experience," said Locke, "this shit dries harder than steel." He ran over to the spot on the wall where the climbing closet would emerge, and he began to slather the grey goo all over the faint cracks that marked its door. "So once I painted all over this lovely concealed entrance, and then pour it into the lock of the main door, why, in about a minute, Requin's going to need a battering ram if he wants to see his office again this evening." Selendri tried to scream for help, but the damage to her throat was too much. It was a loud and eerie sound, but it didn't carry downstairs with the force she needed. Locke scampered down the iron stairs, closed the main doors to Requin's office, and hurriedly sealed the locking mechanism within a glob of already firming cement. "And now," he said when he returned to the centre of the office, "the next curiosity of the evening, concerning this lovely suite of chairs with which I furnished our esteemed host. It turns out that I do know what the Talathri Baroque is, after all, and that there is a reason why someone in his right mind would build such a nice thing out of a wood as fundamentally weak as sheer crescent." Locke seized one of the chairs. He tore the seat cushion and its underlying panel off with his bare hands, exposing a shallow chamber within the seat packed tight with tools and equipment, knives, a leather climbing belt, clips and descenders, and assorted other implements. He shook these out onto the ground with a clatter, and then hoisted the chair above his head, grinning. "It makes them so much easier to smash." And that he did, bringing the chair down hard on Requin's floor. It shattered at all the joints, but didn't fly apart, because its splintered chunks were held together by something threaded through the hollow cavities within its legs and back. Locke fumbled with the wreckage for a few moments before successfully extracting several long lengths of demi-silk line. Locke took one of these, and with Jean's help soon had Selendri tied into the chair behind Requin's desk. She kicked and spat and even tried to bite them, but it was no use. Once she was secured, Locke picked a knife out of the pile of tools on the ground while Jean got to work smashing the other 3 chairs and extracting their hidden contents. As Locke approached Selendri with the blade in his hand, she gave him a contemptuous stare.
"I can't tell you anything meaningful," she said. The vault is at the base of the tower, and you've just sealed yourselves up here. So frighten me all you like, Costa, but I have no idea what you think you're doing.
Oh, you think this is for you? Locke smiled. Selendry, I thought we knew each other better than that. As for the vault, who the hell said anything about it?
Your work to find a way in.
I lied, Selendry. I've been known to do that. You think I was really experimenting on clockwork locks and keeping notes for Maxilla and Stragos? Like hell. I was sipping brandies on your first and second floors, trying to pull myself back together after I nearly got cut to pieces. Your vault's fucking impenetrable, sweetheart. I never wanted to go anywhere near it. Locke glanced around, pretending to notice the room for the very first time. Requin sure does keep a lot of really expensive paintings on his walls, though, doesn't he? With a grin that felt even larger than it was, Locke stepped up to the closest one and began, ever so carefully, to cut it out of its surrounding frame. 7. Locke and Jean threw themselves backward from Requin's balcony 10 minutes later, demi-silk lines leading from their leather belts to the perfect anchor-noose knots they'd tied on the railing. There hadn't been enough room in the chairs for belay lines, but sometimes you couldn't get anywhere in life without taking little risks. Locke hollered as they slid rapidly down through the night air, past balcony after balcony, window after window of bored, satisfied, incurious, or jaded gamers. His glee had temporarily wrestled his sorrow down. He and Jean fell for 20 seconds, using their iron descenders to avoid a headlong plummet, and for those 20 seconds all was right with the world, Crooked Warden be praised. 10 of Requin's prized paintings, lovingly trimmed from their frames, rolled up and stuffed into oilcloth carrying tubes, were slung over his shoulder. He'd had to leave 2 on the wall for lack of carrying cases, but once again space in the chairs had been limited. After Locke had conceived the idea of going after Requin's fairly well-known art collection, he'd nosed around for a potential buyer among the antiquities and diversions merchants of several cities. The price he'd eventually been offered for his hypothetical acquisition of the art objects had been gratifying, to say the least. Their slide ended on the stones of Requin's courtyard, where the ends of their lines hung 3 inches above the ground. Their landing disturbed several drunk couples strolling the perimeter of the yard. No sooner were they shrugging out of their lines and harnesses than they heard the rush of heavily booted feet and the clatter of arms and armor. A squad of 8 eyes ran toward them from the street side of the Sinspire.
"Stand where you are," the eye in the lead bellowed. "As an officer of Archon and Council, I place you under arrest for crimes against Tal'Varar. Raise your hands and offer no struggle, or no quarter will be given."
8. The long, shallow-draft boat drew up against the Archon's private landing, and Locke found his heart hammering. Now came the delicate part, the ever-so-delicate part. He and Jean were thrust from the boat by the eyes surrounding them. Their hands were tied behind their backs, and they'd been relieved of their paintings. Those were carried very carefully by the last of the arresting eyes to step off the boat. The arresting officer stepped up to the eye in command of the landing and saluted.
"We're to take the prisoners to see the Protector immediately, Sword Prefect."
"I know," said the landing officer, an unmistakable note of satisfaction in his voice. "Well done, Sergeant."
"Thank you, sir. The gardens?"
"Yes." Locke and Jean were marched through the Mon Magisteria, through empty hallways and past silent ballrooms, through the smells of weapon oil and dusty corners. At last they emerged into the Archon's gardens. Their feet crunched on the gravel of the path as they made their way through the deeply scented night, past the faint glow of silver creeper and the stuttering luminescence of lantern beetles. Maxilan Stragos sat waiting for them near his boathouse, on a chair brought out for the occasion. With him were Meraine and, oh, how Locke's heart quickened, the bald alchemist, as well as 2 more eyes. The arresting eyes, led by their sergeant, saluted the Archon.
On their knees, said Stragos casually, and Locke and Jean were forced down to the gravel before him.
Locke winced and tried to take in the details of the scene. Meraine wore a long-sleeved tunic and a dark skirt. From his angle, Locke could see that her boots weren't courtly fripperies, but black, flat-soled field boots, good for running and fighting. Interesting. Stragos Alchemist stood with a large grey satchel, looking nervous. Locke's pulse quickened once again at the thought of what might be in that bag.
Stragos, said Locke, pretending that he didn't know exactly what was on the Archon's mind. Another garden party? Your armored jackasses can untie us now. I doubt there are agents of the Priori lurking in the trees.
I have sometimes wondered to myself, said Stragos, precisely what it would take to humble you.
He beckoned the eye at his right side forward.
I have regretfully concluded that it's probably impossible.
The eye kicked Locke in the chest, knocking him backward. Gravel slid beneath him as he tried to squirm away. The eye reached down and yanked him back up by his tunic collar.
"Do you see my alchemist here as you requested?" said Stragos.
"Yes," said Locke.
"That's what you get. All you will ever get. I have kept my word. Enjoy your useless glimpse."
"Stragos, you bastard, we still have work to do for—"
"I think not," said the Archon. "I think your work is already done. And at long last, I think I can see precisely why you so aggravated the Bonds Magi that they passed you into my care."
"Stragos, if we don't get back to the Poison Orchid—"
"My spotters have reported a ship answering that description, anchored to the north of the city. I'll be out to fetch her soon enough, with half the galleys in my fleet, and then I'll have another pirate to parade through the streets, and a crew to drop into the midden deep, one by one, while all of Tal Vahrar cheers me on."
"But we—"
"You have given me what I need," said Stragos, "if not in the manner in which you intended. Sergeant, did you encounter any difficulty in securing these prisoners from the Sin Spire?"
"Requin refused to allow us entry to the structure, Protector."
"Requin refused to allow you entry to the structure," said Stragos, clearly savoring each word, "thereby treating an informal tradition as though it had any precedence over my legal authority, thereby giving me cause to send my troops in platoons and do what the bought and paid for constables won't, throw that bastard in a box until we find out just how long he's willing to stay quiet about the activities of his good friends the Priori. Now I have my fighting chance. There's no need for you two to cause further violence in my waters."
"Stragos, you motherfucker!"
"In fact," said the Archon, "there's no need for you two at all."
"We had a deal!"
"And I would have kept to it, had you not scorned me in the one matter which could brook no disobedience."
Stragos rose from his chair, shaking with anger.
"My instructions were to leave the men and women at Windward Rock alive, alive."
"But we—"
began Locke, absolutely mystified.
"We used the Whitfrost, and we did leave them—" "With their throats cut," said Stragos. "Only the two on the roof lived. I presume you were too lazy to climb up and finish them off."
"We didn't!"
"Who else was raiding my island that night, Costa? It's not exactly a shrine for pilgrims, is it? If you didn't do it, you allowed the prisoners to do it. Either way, the fault is yours."
"Stragos, I honestly don't know what you're talking about."
"That won't bring my four good men and women back, will it?"
Stragos put his hands behind his back.
"And with that, we're done. The sound of your voice, the tone of your arrogance, the sheer effrontery contained within that tongue of yours—
You are sharkskin on my eardrums, Master Costa, and you murdered honest soldiers of Tal'Varar. You will have no priest, no ceremony, and no grave. Sergeant, give me your sword.
The sergeant of the arresting eyes stepped forward and drew his blade. He turned it hilt first toward the Archon.
Stragos, said Jean, one last thing.
Locke turned toward him and saw that he was smiling thinly.
I'm going to remember this moment for the rest of my God's damned life.
Stragos never finished his sentence, since the eye sergeant suddenly drew back his sword arm and slammed the hilt of the weapon into the Archon's face. 9. They did it like this. The eyes removed Locke and Jean from Requin's courtyard and shoved them into a heavy carriage with iron-barred windows. Three entered the compartment with them, two rode up top to tend the horses, and three stood at the sides and rear as outriders. At the end of the street atop the highest tier of the golden steps, where the carriage had to turn left to take the switchblade ramp down to the next level, another carriage suddenly blocked its way. The eyes yelled threats. The driver of the other carriage apologized profusely and shouted that his horses were uncommonly stubborn. Then the crossbow strings began to snap, and the drivers and outriders toppled from their places, caught defenseless in a storm of quarrels. Squads of constables in full uniform appeared on the street to either side of the carriage, waving their staves and shields.
"Move along!"
they shouted at the wide-eyed bystanders, the wisest of whom had already ducked for cover.
"Nothing to see here. Business of Archon and Council."
As the bodies hit the cobblestones outside the carriage, the door flew open and the three inside made a futile attempt to aid their fallen comrades. Two more squads of constables, with help from a number of private individuals in plain dress who just happened to get involved at the same signal, charged and overpowered them. One fought back so hard that he was slain by accident. The other two were soon forced down beside the carriage and their bronze masks removed. Leonis Cordo appeared, wearing the uniform of an eye, complete in every detail save for the mask. He was followed by seven more men and women in nearly complete costumes. With them was a young woman Locke didn't recognize. She knelt in front of the two captured eyes.
"You, I don't know," she said to the one on the right.
Before the man had time to realize what was happening, a constable had passed a dagger across his throat and shoved him to the ground. Other constables were quickly dragging the rest of the bodies out of sight.
"You,"
said the woman, regarding the sole surviving eye.
"Lucius Corlys. You, I know."
"Kill me now," said the man. "I'll give you nothing."
"Of course," said the woman. "But you have a mother and a sister who works in the Black Hands Crescent, and you have a brother by bonding on the fishing boats and two nephews."
"Fuck you," Corlys said. "You wouldn't."
"While you watched, I would. I will. Every single one of them, and you'll be in the room the whole time, and they'll know that you could save them with a few words."
Corlys looked at the ground and began to sob.
"Please," he said, "let this stay between us."
"Tal'Varar remains, Corlys. The Archon isn't Tal'Varar. But I don't have time to play games with you. Answer my questions, or we will find your family."
"Gods forgive me," said Corlys, nodding.
"Were you given any special code phrases or procedures to use when re-entering the Mon Magisteria?"
No.
"What exactly were the orders that you heard given to your sergeant?"
When the brief interrogation was over and Corlys carted off, alive to keep him in fear of consequences should he be leaving anything out, along with the bodies, the false eyes armed themselves with the weapons and harnesses of the real thing and drew on the brass masks. Then the carriage was off again, speeding on its way to the boat waiting at the inner docks, lest any of Stragos' agents should get across the bay in time to warn of what they'd seen.
"That was about as good as we could hope for,"
said Leonis, sitting inside the carriage with them.
"How good are those fake uniforms?" asked Locke. Fake? You misunderstand. The uniforms weren't the hard part. Our sympathizers in Stragos forces supplied us with these some time ago. It's the masks that are damned difficult. One per eye, no spares. They keep them like family heirlooms, and they spend so much time looking at them, even a close copy would be noticed. Cordo held up his mask and grinned. After tonight, hopefully, we'll never see the damned things again. Now what the hell is in those oilcloth tubes?
A gift from Requin, said Locke. Unrelated personal business.
You know Requin well?
We share a taste for the art of the late Therin Throne period, said Locke, smiling. In fact, we've even exchanged some pieces of work recently.
10. As Leonis knocked the Archon to the ground, the other false eyes tore their masks off and took action. Locke and Jean slid out of the purely decorative knots at their wrists in less than a second. One of Leonis' men underestimated the skills of the real eye he faced. He fell to his knees with most of his left side sliced open. Two more Priori pretenders closed in and harried the eye until his guard slipped. They knocked him down and stabbed him several times. The other tried to run and fetch aid, but was slain before he could take five steps. Meraine and the alchemist looked around, the alchemist far more nervously than Meraine, but two of Leonis' people put them at sword point.
"Well, Stragos," said Leonis, hauling the Archon back to his knees, "warmest regards from the House of Cordo."
He raised his arm, sword reversed to strike, and grinned. Jean grabbed him from behind, threw him to the ground, and stood over him, seething.
"The deal, Cordo!"
"Yeah," said Leonis, still smiling where he lay on the ground. "Well, it's like this. You've done us quite a service, but we don't feel comfortable having loose ends running around. And there are now seven of us, and two of..."
"You amateur double-crossers," said Locke. "You make us professionals cringe. You think you're so fucking clever. I saw this coming about 100 miles away, so I had a mutual friend offer an opinion on the subject."
Locke reached into his boot and pulled out a slightly crumpled, moderately sweaty half-sheet of parchment, folded into quarters. Locke passed this to Leonis and smiled, knowing as the Priori unfolded it that he would read, "I would take it as a personal affront if the bearers of this note were to be harmed or hindered in any way, engaged as they are upon an errand of mutual benefit. The extension of every courtesy to them will be noted and returned as though a courtesy to myself. They bear my full and absolute trust. R." All, of course, above Requin's personal seal.
"I know that you yourself are not fond of his chance house," said Locke. "But you must admit that the same is not generally true among the Priori, and many of your peers keep a great deal of money in his vault."
"Enough. I take your point."
Cordo rose to his feet and all but threw the letter back at Locke. "What do you ask?"
"I only want two things," said Locke. "The Archon and his alchemist. What you do with this god's damned city is entirely your business."
"The Archon must..."
"You were about to gut him like a fish. He's my business now. Just know that whatever happens to him won't be an inconvenience for you."
The sound of shouting arose from the other side of the gardens. No, Locke corrected himself, the other side of the fortress.
"What the hell is that?" he asked.
"We have sympathizers at the Mon Magisteria's gate," said Cordo. "We're bringing people in to prevent anyone from leaving. They must be making their presence known."
"If you try to storm..."
"We're not storming the Mon Magisteria, just sealing it off. Once the troops inside comprehend the new situation, we're confident they'll accept the authority of the councils."
"You'd better hope that's the case across Tal Vahrar," said Locke. "But enough of this shit. Hey, Stragos, let's go have a chat with your pet alchemist."
Jean hoisted the Archon, still clearly in shock, to his feet, and began to haul him over to where Meraine and the alchemist were standing under guard.
"You," said Locke,
pointing at the bald man, "are about to start explaining a hell of a lot of things, if you know what's good for you." The alchemist shook his head.
"Oh, but I...
"Pay close attention," said Locke. "This is the end of the Arcanate. Understand? The whole institution is getting sunk in the harbour once and for all tonight. After this, Maxillan Stragos won't have the power to buy a cup of warm piss for all the gold in Tal Vahrar. That will leave you with nobody to go crawling to as you spend the rest of your short, miserable life answering to the two men you fucking poisoned. Do you have a permanent antidote?"
I carry an antidote for every poison I use in the Archon service, yes, just in case."
"Xandrin, don't!" said Stragos.
Jean punched him in the stomach. "Oh, no. Do, Xandrin, do," said Locke. The bald man reached into his satchel and held up a glass vial full of transparent liquid.
"One dose is what I carry. This is enough for one man. Do not split it. This will cleanse the substance from the humours and channels of the body."
Locke took the vial from him, his hand trembling.
"And this? How much will it cost to have another alchemist make more?"
"It's impossible," said Xandrin. "I designed the antidote to defy reactive analysis. Any sample subjected to alchemical scrutiny will be ruined. The poison and its antidote are my proprietary formulation."
"Notes," said Locke. "Recipes, whatever you call the damn things."
"In my head," said Xandrin. "Paper is a poor keeper of secrets."
"Well then," said Locke, "until you cook us up another dose, it looks like you're fucking well coming with us. Do you like the sea?"
11. Meraine made her decision then. If the antidote couldn't be duplicated, and she could knock the vial to the ground, the troublesome anomalies Costa and Deferra were as good as dead. That would leave only Stragos and Xandrin. If they were dealt with, all those with any direct knowledge of the fact that she served a master beyond Tal Vahrar would be silenced. She moved her right arm slightly, dropping the hilt of her poisoned dagger into her hand, and took a deep breath. Meraine moved so fast that the false eye standing to her side never even had the chance to raise his sword. Her sideways stab, not preceded by any telltale glance or lunge, took him in the side of the neck. She slid the blade sideways as she withdrew, tearing whatever she could in case the poison took a few extra seconds to do its work. 12. Meraine's first victim had just uttered a gasp of surprise when she moved again, slashing across the back of Xandrin's neck with a knife she'd produced from nowhere. Locke stared for a split second, startled. He counted himself fast, but if she'd been aiming for him, he realized that he never would have seen the blow coming in time. As Xandrin cried out and stumbled forward, Meraine kicked at Locke, a fast attack rather than a solid one. She caught his arm and the vial flew from his fingers. Locke barely had time to yell, "Shit!" before he was diving after it, heedless of the gravel he was about to skin himself against or anything else Meraine might care to do to him. He plucked the still-intact vial off the ground, uttered a whisper of thanks, and was then knocked aside as Jean rushed past, arms extended. As he hit the ground with the vial clutched to his chest, Locke saw Meraine wind up and hurl her knife. Jean struck her at the moment of release, so that rather than impaling Stragos through the neck or chest, as she'd clearly intended, she bounced her blade off the gravel at his feet. The Archon flinched away from the weapon nonetheless. Meraine, improbably, put up an effective struggle against Jean. She freed one arm from his grasp somehow and elbowed him in the ribs. Lithe and no doubt desperate as all hell, she kicked his left foot, broke his grip, and tried to stumble away. Jean retained enough of a hold on her tunic to tear off her left sleeve all the way to the shoulder. Thrown off balance as it gave way, he fell to the ground. Locke caught a flash of an elaborate dark tattoo against the pale skin of Meraine's upper arm, something like a grapevine entwined around a sword. Then she was off like a crossbow bolt, darting into the night, away from Jean and the false eyes who chased her in vain for a few dozen steps before giving up and swearing loudly.
"Well, what the... oh, hell!"
said Locke, noticing for the first time that the false eye Meryn had stabbed, along with Xandrin, was writhing on the ground with rivulets of foaming saliva trickling from the corners of his mouth.
"Oh, shit! Shit! Hell!"
Locke shouted, bending helplessly over the dying alchemist. The convulsions ceased in just a few seconds, and Locke stared down at the single vial of antidote in his hands, a sick feeling in the pit of his stomach.
"No,"
said Jean from behind him.
"Oh, gods, why did she do that?"
"I don't know," said Locke.
"What the hell do we do?"
"We...
shit!
Damned if I know that, either."
"You should."
"Nobody's doing anything," said Locke. "I'll keep this safe. Once this is over, we'll sit down with it, have dinner, talk it over. We'll come up with something."
"You can..." "Time to go," said Locke, lowering his voice to an urgent whisper. "Get what we came here for and go, before things get more complicated."
Before troops loyal to the Archon notice that he's having a bad night, before Leonis finds out that Requin is actually hunting for us as we speak, before some other god's damned surprise crawls out of the ground to bite us on the ass.
"Cordo!" he shouted. "Where's that bag you promised?"
Leonis gestured to one of his surviving false eyes, and the woman passed a heavy burlap sack to Locke. Locke shook it out. It was wider than he was, and nearly 6 feet long.
"Well, Maxillan," he said, "I offered you the chance to forget all of this and let us go and keep what you had. But you had to be a fucking asshole, didn't you?"
"Custa," said Stragos, at least seeming to recover his voice, I can give you..."
"You can't give me a god's damned thing."
Stragos seemed to be thinking of making an attempt for Meryn's dagger, so Locke gave it a hard kick. It skittered across the gravel and into the darkness of the gardens.
"Those of us in our profession, those who hold with the crooked warden, have a little tradition we follow when someone close to us dies. In this case, someone who got killed as a result of this mad fucking scheme of yours."
"Costa, don't throw away what I can offer."
"We call it a death offering," said Locke. "Means we steal something of value, proportional to the life we lost. Except in this case, I don't think there's anything in the world that qualifies. But we're doing our best."
Jean stepped up beside him and cracked his knuckles.
"Ezre del Mastro," he said very quietly, "I give you the Archon of Tal Verar."
He punched Stragos so hard that the Archon's feet left the gravel. In a moment, he was stuffing the unconscious old man into the burlap sack. Another moment, and the sack was tied off and slung over his shoulders like a bag of potatoes.
"Well, Leonis," said Locke, "best of luck with your revolution, or whatever the hell it is. We're sneaking out of here before things have a chance to get any more interesting on us."
"And Stragos?"
"You'll never see him again," said Locke.
"Good enough, then. Are you leaving the city?"
"Not half fast enough for our god's damned taste."
13. Jean dumped him on the quarterdeck, under the eyes of Zamira and all the surviving crew. It had been a long and arduous trip back, first to retrieve their backpacks from Cordo's little boat, and then to dutifully retrieve Drakasha's ship's boat, and then to row nearly out to sea. But it had all been worth it. The entire night had been worth it, Locke decided, just to see the expression on Stragos' face when he found Zamira standing over him.
"Drakasha,"
he mumbled, then spit one of his teeth onto the deck. Blood ran in several streams down his chin.
"Maxillan Stragos, former Archon of Tal Verar," she said. "Final Archon of Tal Verar. Last time I saw you, my perspective was somewhat different. as was mine," he sighed. "What now? There are too many debts riding on your carcass to buy them off with death," said Zamira. "We thought long and hard about this. We've decided that we're going to try to keep you around as long as we possibly can." She snapped her fingers, and Jibril stepped forward, carrying a mass of sturdy, if slightly rusted, iron chains and cuffs in his arms. He dropped them on the deck next to Stragos and laughed as the old man jumped. The hands of other crew folk seized him, and he began to sob in disbelief as his legs and arms were clamped and as the chains were draped around him. "You're going in the orlop, Stragos. You're going into the dark. And we're going to treat it as a special privilege, to carry you around with us wherever we go, in any weather, in any sea, in any heat. We're going to haul you a mighty long way, you and your irons. Long after your clothes fall off, I guarantee, you'll still have those to wear."
"Drakasha, please!"
"Throw him as far down as we got," she said, and half a dozen crewfolk began carrying him toward a main deck hatch. "Chain him to the bulkhead, then let him get cozy."
"Drakasha!" he screamed. "You can't! You can't! I'll go mad!"
"I know," she said, "and you'll scream. Gods, how you'll wail down there. But that's okay. We can always do with a bit of music at sea." Then he was carried below the Poison Orchid's deck to the rest of his life. "Well," said Drakasha, turning to Locke and Jean, "you two delivered. I'll be damned, but you got what you wanted."
"No, Captain," said Jean. "We got what we went after, mostly, but we didn't get what we wanted, not by a long God's damned shot."
"I'm sorry, Jerome," she said.
"I hope nobody ever calls me that again," said Jean. "The name is Jean."
"Locke and Jean," she said. "All right, then. Can I take you to somewhere?"
"Velverazzo, if you don't mind," said Locke. "We've got some business to transact."
"And then you'll be rich men?"
"We'll be in funds, yes. Do you want some for your..."
"No," she said. "You went into Talvera and did the stealing. Keep it. We've got swag enough from Salon Corbeau, and so few ways to split it now. We'll be fine."
"So what will you do after that?"
"We had a plan," said Locke.
"Remember what you told me at the rail that night? If someone tries to draw lines around your ship, just set more sail?"
Drakasha nodded.
"I guess you could say we're going to give it a try," said Locke.
"Will you need anything else, then?"
"Well," said Locke, "for safety's sake, given our past history, perhaps you'd let us consider borrowing one of your ship's cats?"
14.
They met the next day, at Requin's invitation, in what could only be described as the wreckage of his office. The main door was smashed off its hinges, the suite of chairs still lay broken across the floor, and of course almost all of the paintings on the walls had been sliced out of their frames. Requin seemed to derive a perverse pleasure in seating the 7 priori on fine chairs in the midst of the chaos, and pretending that all was perfectly normal. Selendri paced the room behind the guests.
"Has everything gone more smoothly for you ladies and gentlemen since last night?" asked Requin.
"Fighting's ended in the Sword Marina," said Jacantha Tiga, youngest of the inner 7. "The navy is on the leash."
"The Mon Magisteria is ours,"
said Leonis Cordo, standing in for his father.
"All of Stragos' captains are in custody, except for 2 captains of intelligence."
"We can't have another fucking Ravel incident," said a middle-aged priori.
"I've got people working on that issue myself," said Requin. "They won't go to ground within the city, I can promise that much."
The ambassadors from Talisham, Espara, and the Kingdom of the Seven Marrows have publicly expressed confidence in the leadership of the council, said Tiga.
I know, said Requin, smiling. I forgave them some rather substantial debts last night, and suggested that they might make themselves useful to the new regime. Now, what about the eyes?
About half of them are alive and in custody, said Cordo. The rest are dead, with just a few thought to be trying to stir up resistance.
They won't get far, said Tiga. Loyalty to the old Arcanate won't buy food or beer. I expect they'll turn up dead here and there once they annoy the regulars too much.
We'll have the rest quietly gotten rid of over the next few days, said Cordo.
Now, I wonder, said Requin, if that's really so very wise. The eyes of the Archon represent a significant pool of highly trained and committed people. Surely there's got to be a better use for them than filling graves.
They were loyal to Stragos alone.
Or perhaps to Tal Vahrar, were you to ask them. Requin placed a hand over his heart. My patriotic duty compels me to point this out.
Cordo snorted. They were his shock troops, his bodyguards, his torturers. They're useless to us, if not actively seditious.
Perhaps, for all of his vaunted military understanding, our dear departed Archon employed the eyes inefficiently, said Requin. Perhaps the business with the faceless masks was too much. They might have been better off in plain clothes, as an enhancement to his intelligence apparatus, rather than terrorizing people as his enforcers. Maybe for his sake, said Tiga. Had he done so, that intelligence apparatus might have foiled our move against him yesterday. It was a close thing.
Still, said Cordo, hard to keep a kingdom when you no longer have a king.
Yes, said Tiga. We're all so very impressed, Cordo. Subtly mention your involvement in passing as often as you like, please.
At least I...
And more difficult still to keep a kingdom, interrupted Requin, when you discard perfectly good tools left behind by the king.
Forgive us our density, said Saravel Fioran, a woman nearly as old as Marius Cordo. But what precisely are you driving at, Requin?
Merely that the eyes, properly vetted and retrained, could be a significant asset to Tal Vahrar, if used not as shock troops, but as a secret constabulary?
Says the man in charge of the very people such a force would be charged with hunting down, scoffed Cordo.
Younger Cordo, said Requin, those are also the very people whose interference with your family business is kept to an acceptable minimum through my involvement. They are the very people who were instrumental in delivering our victory yesterday, carrying your messages, filling the streets to detain army reinforcements, distracting Stragos' most loyal officers while some of you were allowed to approach this affair with the air of amateurs dabbling at lawn bowling.
Not I, said Cordo.
No, not you. You did fight, but I flaunt my hypocrisy with a smile on my face, Leonis. Don't you dare pretend, here in our highest privacy, that your disdain somehow absolves you for your involvement with the likes of me. You don't want to imagine a city with crime unregulated by the likes of me. As for the eyes, I am not asking, I am telling. Those few who were true fanatics for Stragos can conveniently trip and land on swords, yes. The rest are too useful to throw away.
On what grounds, said Tiga, do you presume to lecture?
On the grounds that six of the seven people sitting here have seen fit to store goods and funds at the Sinspire vault. Items that, let us be frank, need not ever reappear in the event that I begin to feel anxious about our relationship. I have an investment in this city, the same as you. I would not take kindly to having a foreign power interrupt my affairs. To give Stragos his due, I cannot imagine that the army and navy in your hands will inspire a great deal of awe in our enemies, given what happened last time the Priori governed during a war. Therefore, I see fit to hedge all of our bets.
Surely we could discuss this in just a few days, said Leonis.
I think not. Inconveniences like our surviving eyes have a habit of disappearing before arguments can broaden, don't they? It's a busy time. Messages might be lost or misconstrued, and I'm sure there'd be a perfectly plausible reason for whatever happened.
So what do you want? Asked Fioran.
If you're going to take the Mon Magisteria as an administrative center for our shiny new government, I would imagine that a suite of offices would be a good start. Something nice and prestigious, before all the nice ones are gone. Plus, I'll expect a rudimentary operating budget by the end of the week. I'll set down the rough finicking myself. Salaries for the next year. Speaking of which, I will expect at least 3 or 4 positions within the hierarchy of this new organization to be placed entirely at my discretion. Salaries in the range of 10 to 15 solari per annum.
So you can pass out sinecures to some of your jumped-up thieves, said Leonis.
So I can aid them in their transition to life as respectable citizens and defenders of Tal Vahrar. Yes, said Requin.
Will this be your own transition to life as a respectable citizen? Asked Tiga.
Here I thought I already was, said Requin. Gods, no. I have no desire to turn away from the responsibilities I currently enjoy. But it just so happens that I have an ideal candidate in mind to head our new organization. Someone who shares my qualms about the manner in which Stragos employed his eyes, and should be taken all the more seriously for the fact that she used to be one.
Selendri couldn't help smiling as the Priori turned in their seats to stare at her.
Now, Requin, hold on, said Cordo.
I see no need, said Requin. I don't believe your 6 fellows are actually going to deny me this very minor and very patriotic request, are they?
Cordo looked around, and Selendri knew what he was seeing on the faces of the other Priori. If he formally tried to stop this, he would be alone, and he would weaken not only his father's borrowed position, but his own future prospects.
I think her starting compensation should be something handsome. Rather handsome, said Requin cheerfully, and of course she'll require use of official carriages and barges, an official residence. Stragos had dozens of houses and manors at his disposal. Oh, and I think her office at the Mon Magisteria should be the nicest and most prestigious of all. Don't you?
They kissed one another for a very long time, alone in the office once the Priori had left in various states of bemusement, worry, and aggravation. As he usually did, Requin removed his gloves to run the brown, pocked skin of his hands over her, over the matching scar tissue on her left-hand side, as well as the healthy flesh on her right.
"There you are, my dear," he said. I know you've been chafing here for some time, running up and down these tower steps, fetching and bowing for drunkards of quality.
I'm still sorry for my failure to...
Our failure was entirely shared, said Requin. In fact, I fell for Costa and De Ferra's line of bullshit harder than you did. You retained your suspicion the whole way. Left to your own devices, you would have thrown them out the window early on and avoided the entire mess at the end, I'm sure.
She smiled.
And those smirking Priori assume I'm inflicting one last grand sinecure on them where you're concerned.
Requin ran his fingers through her hair. "Gods, are they in for a surprise? I can't wait to see you in action. You'll build something that will make my little coteries of Felantotsi look tawdry." Selendri stared around at the wreckage of the office. Requin laughed. "I suppose," he said, "that I have to admire the audacious little shits. To spend 2 years planning such a thing, and then the business with the chairs, and with my seal. My, Leonis was throwing a fit."
"I'd have thought you'd be furious," said Selendri.
"Furious? I suppose I am. I was rather fond of that suite of chairs."
"I know how long you worked to acquire those paintings."
"Ah, the paintings, yes." Requin grinned mischievously. "Well, as for that, the walls have been left somewhat under-decorated. How would you like to go down to the vault with me to start fetching out the real ones?"
"What do you mean, the real ones?"
Epilogue. Red Seas Under Red Skies. 1.
"What the hell do you mean, reproductions?"
Locke sat in a comfortable, high-backed wooden chair in the study of Acastus Krell, fine divisions dealer of Velverazzo. He wrapped both hands around his slender glass of lukewarm tea to avoid spilling it.
"Surely you can't be unfamiliar with the term, Master Fairwhite," said Krell.
The old man would have been stick-like if not for the grace of his movements. He paced his study like a dancer in a stage production, manipulated his magnifying lenses like a duelist striking a pose. He wore a loose brocaded gown of twilight blue silk, and as he looked up now, the hairless gleam of his head emphasized the eerily penetrating nature of his stare. This study was Krell's lair, the center of his existence. It lent him an air of authority.
"I am," said Locke, "in the matter of furniture, but as for paintings—"
"It's a rarer thing, to be sure, but there can be no doubt. I have never actually seen the original versions of these 10 paintings, gentlemen, but there are critical incongruities in the pigments, brush strokes, and general weathering of their surfaces. They are not genuine art objects of the Talathri Baroque."
Jean absorbed this morosely, hands folded before him, saying nothing and ignoring his tea. Locke tasted bile in the back of his throat.
"Explain,"
he said, struggling to keep his temper in check. Krell sighed, his own aggravation clearly tempered by sympathy for their situation.
"Look,"
he said, carefully holding up one of the paintings they'd stolen, an image of Therin-throne nobles seated at a gladiatorial game, receiving the tribute of a mortally wounded fighter.
"Whoever painted this is a master artisan, a fantastically patient and skillful individual. It would have required hundreds of hours per painting, and the work must have been done with full access to the originals. Obviously the gentlemen from which you procured these objects had qualms about exposing the originals to danger. I'd wager my house and all of its gardens that they're in his vault."
"But the incongruities, how can you know?"
"The master artists patronized by the last court of the Therin throne had a secret means to distinguish their works from those produced by artists serving lesser patrons. A fact not known outside the emperor's court until years after it fell. In their paintings, Talathri's chosen masters and their associates would deliberately create a very slight visual flaw in one corner of the work, by using brush strokes whose size and direction jarred with those immediately surrounding them. The imperfection that proclaims perfection, as it were, like the beauty mark some Vajrans favour for their ladies."
"And you can tell this at a glance?"
I can tell well enough when I find no hint of it anywhere on any of these 10 works.
Damnation, said Locke.
It suggests to me, said Krell, that the artist who created these, or their employer, so genuinely admired the original works that they refused to counterfeit their hidden marks of distinction.
Well, that's very heartwarming.
I can tell you require further proof, Master Fairwhite, and fortunately what remains is even clearer. First, the brightness of these pigments is impossible, given the state of alchemy 400 years ago. The vibrancy of these hues bespeaks a contemporary origin. Lastly, and most damningly, there is no veneer of age upon these works, no fine cracks in the pigment, no discoloration from mould or sunlight, no intrusion of smoke into the overlying lacquers. The flesh of these works, as it were, is as distinct from the genuine article as my face would be from that of a 10-year-old boy.
Krell smiled sadly.
I have aged to a fine old state. These have not.
So what does this mean for our arrangement?
I am aware,
said Krell, settling into the chair behind his desk and setting the painting down,
that you must have undergone extraordinary hardship in securing even these facsimiles from the gentleman in Talvarar. You have my thanks and my admiration.
Jean snorted and stared at the wall.
Your thanks, said Locke, and your admiration, however well meant,
are not legal tender, said Krell. I'm not a simpleton, Master Fairwhite. For these 10 paintings I can still offer you 2,000 salari.
2? Locke clutched the armrests of his chair and leaned forward. The sum we originally discussed was 30,000, Master Krell.
And for originals, said Krell, I would have gladly paid that original sum. For genuine artifacts of the last flowering, I would have had buyers in distant locations completely unconcerned with the potential displeasure of the gentleman in Talvarar.
2, muttered Locke. Gods, we left more than that sitting at the Sinspire. 2,000 solari for 2 years is what you're offering us.
No, Krell steepled his spindly fingers. 2,000 solari for 10 paintings. However much I regret what you might have endured to recover these objects, there were no hardship clauses in our agreement. I am paying for goods, not the process required to retrieve them.
3,000, said Locke.
2,500. Said Krell, and not a centira more. I can find buyers for these. Each of them is still a unique object worth hundreds of solari, and well worth possessing or displaying. If pressed, after time passes, I can even attempt to sell them back to the gentleman in Talvarar, claiming that I procured them in some distant city. I don't doubt that he would be generous. But if you don't wish to accept my price, you are free to take them to a market square, or a tavern, perhaps.
2,500, said Locke. Damn it all to hell!
So I suspect we shall be, Master Fairwhite, in our own good time. But now I'd like a decision. Do you accept the offer?
2,500, said Locke for the 15th time as their carriage rattled toward Velverazzo's marina. I don't fucking believe it. It's more than a lot of people have, I suppose, muttered Jean. But it's not what I promised, said Locke. I'm sorry, Jean, I fucked up again. Tens of thousands, I said. Huge score. Put us back at the top of our games.
Lashani nobleman. Gods above. He put his head in his hands. Crooked warden, why the hell do you ever listen to me?
It wasn't your fault, said Jean. We did pull it off. We did get out with everything we planned. It's just, it was the wrong everything. There was no way we could know.
Shit, said Locke. Their carriage slowed, then creaked to a halt. There was a clatter and a scrape as their footman placed a wooden step, and then the door opened into daylight. The smell of the sea flooded into the compartment, along with the sound of crying gulls.
"Do you still want to do this?" Locke bit his lip at Jean's lack of reaction.
"I know that she was meant to be here with us. We can just forget about it, leave it where it is, take carriages."
"It's fine," said Jean.
He pointed at the burlap bag on the seat beside Locke. The bag seemed to be undulating, possessed by a motive force within itself.
"Besides, we went to the trouble of bringing a cat this time."
"I suppose we did." Locke poked the bag and smiled thinly at the resulting attack from inside. "But still, you..."
Jean was already rising to leave the carriage.
3.
Master Fairwhite, so pleased to finally make your acquaintance, and yours as well, Master.
Callus, said Locke. Tavrin Callus. Forgive my friend, he's had a trying day. I'll conduct our business.
Of course, said the master of Velverazzo's private yacht harbour.
Here the pleasure barges and day-sailing vessels of Velverazzo's notable families, who could be counted on two hands without using all the available fingers, were kept under constant guard. The harbour-master led them to the end of one of his docks, where a sleek one-masted sailing vessel rocked gently on the swells. 40 feet long, lacquered teak and witchwood, trimmed with brass and silver. Her rigging was the finest new demi-silk, and her furled sails were the white of clean beach sand.
"Everything prepared according to your letters, Master Fairwhite," said the harbour-master. "I apologize for the fact that it required 4 days rather than 3.
"No matter," said Locke. He passed over a leather satchel containing solari he'd counted out in the carriage. "Balance of payment in full, and the promised 3-day bonus for your working party. I've no reason to be stingy."
"You are entirely too kind," said the harbour-master, bowing as he accepted the heavy purse. "Nearly 800 solari gone already."
"And the provisions?" asked Locke.
"Complete as specified," said the harbour-master. "Rations and water for a week. The wines, the oil cloaks and other emergency gear, all there and checked by myself."
"Our dinner?"
"Coming," said the harbour-master. "Coming. I expected a runner several minutes ago. Wait, here's the boy now."
Locke glanced back toward their carriage. A small boy had just appeared from behind it, jogging with a covered basket larger than his chest cradled in his arms. Locke smiled.
"Our dinner concludes our business," he said, as the boy approached and handed the basket up to Jean.
"Very good, Master Fairwhite. Tell me, will you be putting out..."
"Immediately," said Locke. "We have a great many things to leave behind."
"Will you require assistance?"
"We had expected a third," said Locke quietly, "but the two of us will suffice." He stared at their new boat, at the once alien arrangement of sails, rigging, mast, tiller. "We're always sufficient."
It took them less than 5 minutes to load the boat with their luggage from the carriage. They had little to speak of, a few spare clothes, work tunics and breeches, weapons, and their little kit of thieves' conveniences. The sun was setting into the west as Jean began to untie them from the dock. Locke hopped down onto the stern deck, a room-sized space surrounded by raised gunwales, and as his last act before their departure, he opened the burlap sack and released the contents onto the boat. The black kitten looked up at him, stretched, and began to rub himself against Locke's right boot, purring loudly.
"Welcome to your new home, kid. All that you survey is yours," said Locke.
But this doesn't mean I'm getting attached to you. 4. They anchored 100 yards out from the last of Velvirazzo's lantern towers, and beneath their ruby light they had the dinner that Locke had promised. They sat on the stern deck, legs folded, with a small table between them. They each pretended to be absorbed in their bread and chicken, in their shark fins and vinegar, in their grapes and black olives. Regal attempted to make war on their meal several times, and only accepted an honorable peace after Locke bribed him with a chicken wing nearly the size of his body. They went through a bottle of wine, a nondescript Camori white, the sort of thing that smooths a meal along without becoming its centerpiece. Locke tossed the empty bottle overboard, and they started another, more slowly.
"It's time," Jean said at last,
when the sun had moved so low in the west that it seemed to be sinking into the starboard gunwale. It was a red moment, all the world from sea to sky the color of a darkening rose petal, of a drop of blood not yet dry. The sea was calm and the air was still. They were without interruptions, without responsibilities, without a plan or an appointment anywhere in the world. Locke sighed, removed a glass vial of clear liquid from his inner coat pocket, and set it on the table. "We discussed splitting it," he said.
"We did," said Jean. "But that's not what we're doing."
"Oh?"
"You're going to drink it."
Jean set both of his hands on the table, palm down.
"All of it."
"No," said Locke.
"You don't have a choice," said Jean.
"Who the hell do you think you are?"
"We can't take the chance of splitting it," said Jean,
his voice reasonable and controlled in just the fashion that told Locke he was ready for instant action.
"Better that one of us be cured for certain than for both of us to linger on and die like that."
"I'll take my chances with lingering on," said Locke.
"I won't," said Jean. "Please drink it, Locke."
"Or what?"
"Or you know what," said Jean. "You can't overpower me. The reverse is definitely not true."
"So you'll—"
"Awake or unconscious," said Jean, "it's yours. I don't care. Drink the fucking antidote for the crooked warden's sake."
"I can't," said Locke.
"Then you force me to—"
"You don't understand," said Locke. "I didn't say won't. I can't."
"What?"
"That's just water in a vial I picked up in town." Locke reached once more into his pocket, withdrew an empty glass vial, and slowly set it down beside the fake. "I have to say, knowing me the way you do, I'm surprised you agreed to let me pour your wines." 5.
"You bastard!"
Jean roared, leaping to his feet.
"Gentleman bastard!" "You miserable fucking son of a bitch!"
Jean was a blur as he moved, and Locke flinched backward in alarm. Jean snatched up the table and flung it into the sea, scattering the remnants of their dinner across the boat's deck.
"How could you? How could you do that to me?"
"I can't watch you die," said Locke flatly. "I can't. You couldn't ask me to."
"So you didn't even give me a choice?"
"You were going to fucking force-feed it to me." Locke stood up, brushing crumbs and chicken bone fragments from his tunic. "I knew you'd try something like that. Do you blame me for doing it first?"
"Now I get to watch you die, is that it? Her, and now you? And this is a favor?"
Jean collapsed onto the deck, buried his face in his hands, and began to sob. Locke knelt beside him and wrapped his arms around his shoulders.
"It is a favor," said Locke. "A favor to me. You saved my life all the time because you're an idiot and you don't know any better. Let me do it for you just once, because you actually deserve it."
"I don't understand any of this,"
Jean whispered.
"You son of a fucking bitch! How can you do this? I want to hug you, and I want to tear your God's damned head off, both at once.
Ah, said Locke, near as I can tell, that's the definition of family right there.
But you'll die,
whispered Jean. It was always going to happen, said Locke. It was always going to happen, and the only reason it didn't happen before now is you, actually.
I hate this, said Jean.
I do too, but it's done. I suppose I have to feel okay about it. I feel calm, he thought. I guess I can say that. I feel calm.
What do we do now?
Same as we planned, said Locke. Somewhere, anywhere, laziest possible speed. Up the coast, just roaming. No one after us. No one in the way, no one to rob. We've never really done this sort of thing before. Locke grinned. Hell, I honestly don't know if we'll be any good at it.
And what if you...
When I do, said Locke. Forgive me.
Yes, said Jean. And no, never.
I understand, I think, said Locke. Get up and give me a hand with the anchor, would you?
What do you have in mind?
This coast is so God's damned old, said Locke. Falling apart. Seen it, seen everywhere like it. Let's see if we can't get this thing pointed somewhere else. He stood up, keeping one of his hands on Jean's shoulder. Somewhere new. This concludes Red Seas Under Red Skies.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.